Chapter 3 of Revolution and Counter-Revolution, or Germany in 1848. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Revolution and Counter-Revolution, or Germany in 1848, by Karl Marx. Chapter 3. The Other German States. November 6, 1851. In our last, we confined ourselves almost exclusively to that state which, during the years 1840 to 1848, was by far the most important in the German movement, namely, to Prussia. It is, however, time to pass a rapid glance over the other states of Germany during the same period. As to the petty states, they had, ever since the revolutionary movements of 1830, completely passed under the dictatorship of the Diet, that is, of Austria and Prussia. The several constitutions, established as much as a means of defense against the dictates of the larger states as to ensure popularity to their princely authors and unity to heterogeneous assemblies of provinces formed by the Congress of Vienna without any leading principle whatever, these constitutions, illusory as they were, had yet proved dangerous to the authority of the petty princes themselves during the exciting times of 1830 and 1831. They were all but destroyed. Whatever of them was allowed to remain was less than a shadow, and it required the loquacious self-complacency of a Welker, a Rotteck, a Dahlmann, to imagine that any results could possibly flow from the humble opposition, mingled with degrading flattery, which they were allowed to show off in the impotent chambers of these petty states. The more poetic portion of the middle class in these smaller states, very soon after 1840, abandoned all the hopes they had formerly based upon the development of parliamentary government in these dependencies of Austria and Prussia. No sooner had the Prussian bourgeoisie and the classes allied to it shown a serious resolution to struggle for parliamentary government in Prussia than they were allowed to take the lead of the constitutional movement over all non-Austrian Germany. It is a fact which now will not any longer be contested that the nucleus of those constitutionalists of central Germany, who afterwards seceded from the Frankfurt National Assembly, and who, from the place of their separate meetings, were called the Gotha Party, long before 1848 contemplated a plan which, with little modification, they in 1849 proposed to the representatives of all Germany. They intended a complete exclusion of Austria from the German Confederation, the establishment of a new confederation with a new fundamental law, and with a federal parliament of the more insignificant states into the larger ones. All this was to be carried out the moment Prussia entered into the ranks of constitutional monarchy, established the liberty of the press, assumed a policy independent from that of Russia and Austria, and thus enabled the constitutionalists of the lesser states to obtain a real control over their respective governments. The inventor of this scheme was Professor Gervinus of Heidelberg, Baden. Thus the emancipation of the Prussian bourgeoisie was to be the signal for that of the middle classes of Germany generally, and for an alliance, offensive and defensive, of both against Russia and Austria, for Austria was, as we shall see presently, considered as an entirely barbarian country, of which very little was known, and that little not to the credit of its population. Austria, therefore, was not considered as an essential part of Germany. As to the other classes of society, in the smaller states they followed, more or less rapidly, in the wake of their equals in Prussia. The shopkeeping class got more and more dissatisfied with their respective governments, with the increase of taxation, with the curtailments of those political sham privileges of which they used to boast when comparing themselves to the slaves of despotism in Austria and Prussia. But as yet they had nothing definite in their opposition which might stamp them as an independent party, distinct from the constitutionalism of the higher bourgeoisie. The dissatisfaction among the peasantry was equally growing, but it is well known that this section of the people, in quiet and peaceful times, will never assert its interests and assume its position as an independent class, except in countries where universal suffrage is established. The working classes in the trades and manufactures of the towns commenced to be infected with the poison of socialism and communism, but there being few towns of any importance out of Russia, and still fewer manufacturing districts, the movement of this class, owing to the want of centers of action and propaganda, was extremely slow in the smaller states. Both in Prussia and in the smaller states, the difficulty of giving vent to political opposition created a sort of religious opposition in the parallel movements of German Catholicism and Free Congregationalism. History affords us numerous examples where, in countries which enjoy the blessings of a state church and where political discussion is fettered, the profane and dangerous opposition against the worldly power is hid under the more sanctified and apparently more disinterested struggle against spiritual despotism. Many a government that will not allow of any of its acts being discussed will hesitate before it creates martyrs and excites the religious fanaticism of the masses. Thus, in Germany, in 1845, in every state, either the Roman Catholic or the Protestant religion, or both, were considered part and parcel of the law of the land. In every state, too, the clergy of either of those denominations, or of both, formed an essential part of the bureaucratic establishment of the government. To attack Protestant or Catholic orthodoxy, to attack priestcraft, was then to make an underhand attack upon the government itself. As to the German Catholics, their very existence was an attack upon the Catholic governments of Germany, particularly Austria and Bavaria, and as such it was taken by those governments. The Free Congregationalists, Protestant dissenters, somewhat resembling the English and American Unitarians, openly confessed their opposition to the clerical and rigidly orthodox tendency of the King of Prussia and his favorite minister for the educational and clerical department, Mr. Eichhorn. The two sects, rapidly extending for a moment, the first in Catholic, the second in Protestant countries, had no other distinction but their different origin. As to their tenets, they perfectly agreed upon this most important point, that all definite dogmas were nugatory. This want of any definition was their very essence. They pretended to build that great temple under the roof of which all Germans might unite. They thus represented, in a religious form, another political idea of the day, that of German unity, and yet they could never agree among themselves. The idea of German unity, which the above-mentioned sects sought to realize at least upon religious ground by inventing a common religion for all Germans, manufactured expressly for their use, habits, and taste, this idea was indeed very widely spread, particularly in the smaller states. Ever since the dissolution of the German Empire by Napoleon, the cry for a union of all the disjecta membra of the German body had been the most general expression of discontent with the established order of things, and most so in the smaller states, where costliness of a court, an administration, an army, in short, the dead weight of taxation, increased in a direct ratio with the smallness and impotency of the state. But what this German unity was to be when carried out was a question upon which parties disagreed. The bourgeoisie, which wanted no serious revolutionary convulsion, were satisfied with what we have seen they considered practicable, namely a union of all Germany, exclusive of Austria, under the supremacy of a constitutional government of Prussia, and surely without conjuring dangerous storms, nothing more could, at that time, be done. The shopkeeping class and the peasantry, as far as these latter troubled themselves about such things, never arrived at any definition of that German unity they so loudly clamored after. A few dreamers, mostly feudalist reactionists, hoped for the re-establishment of the German Empire. Some few ignorant, soi-disant radicals, admiring Swiss institutions, of which they had not yet made that practical experience which afterwards most ludicrously undeceived them, pronounced for a federated republic, and it was only the most extreme party which, at that time, dared pronounce for a German republic, one and indivisible. Thus German unity was in itself a question big with disunion, discord, and, in the case of certain eventualities, even civil war. To resume, then, this was the state of Prussia and the smaller states of Germany at the end of 1847. The middle class, feeling their power and resolved not to endure much longer the fetters with which a feudal and bureaucratic despotism enchained their commercial transactions, their industrial productivity, their common action as a class. A portion of the landed nobility, so far changed into producers of mere marketable commodities as to have the same interests and to make common cause with the middle class. The smaller trading class, dissatisfied, grumbling at the taxes, at the impediments thrown in the way of their business, but without any definite plan for such reforms as should secure their position in the social and political body. The peasantry, oppressed here by feudal exactions, there by moneylenders, usurers, and lawyers. The working people of the towns infected with the general discontent, equally hating the government and the large industrial capitalists, and catching the contagion of socialist and communist ideas. In short, a heterogeneous mass of opposition springing from various interests, but more or less led on by the bourgeoisie, in the first ranks of which again marched the bourgeoisie of Prussia, and particularly of the Rhine province. On the other hand, governments disagreeing upon many points, distrustful of each other, and particularly of that of Prussia, upon which yet they had to rely for protection. In Prussia, a government forsaken by public opinion, forsaken by even a portion of the nobility, leaning upon an army and a bureaucracy which every day got more infected by the ideas and subjected to the influence of the oppositional bourgeoisie. A government, besides all this, penniless in the most literal meaning of the word, and which could not procure a single cent to cover its increasing deficit, but by surrendering at discretion to the opposition of the bourgeoisie. Was there ever a more splendid position for the middle class of any country, while it struggled for power against the established government? London, September 1851. End of chapter 3.